Catherine Austin Fitz is back on. It's been a while. And we'll pick up kind of where she left off with George Norrie. We'll talk a little bit about the black budget of the federal government. Also, federal money laundering, as it were, with what's being done in certain branches of government with missing trillions of dollars. And we'll talk a lot about what you're hearing in the news about this housing bubble that might just burst. Well, this was a foreseeable outcome. Who is behind this? Why has it come to where we are? Is it just market forces? Just things that couldn't be helped that sometimes go awry and need to be occasionally corrected? Who's in line? Who's going to be paid off big time from this government bailout? Who's going to be making the money? And what is a tapeworm economy next on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. Catherine Austin Fitz has been with the Wall Street investment firm, a securities investment bank, and she is also the former assistant secretary of housing and a federal housing commissioner. What years were those, Catherine?
That was in 1989 and 1990 in the first Bush administration.
So thank you for coming on, especially because we were going to talk to you and then, boom, all this stuff started happening in the news anyway, so it just made it all the more timely. But let me go back a little bit because I missed the show you did with George Norrie back in 2005.
Uh-huh.
Tell me a little bit about this black budget.
Well, what George and I had started with was I was writing a series of articles about $4 trillion missing from the U.S. Treasury starting in fiscal 1998 through about 2002. And part of that related to the fact that the United States government, when I was in the first Bush administration, in fact, that was cleaning up the last housing bubble burst, we were able to get laws passed requiring the federal government to publish financial statements, audited financial statements. And a process began in the mid-90s where the federal government would report that it had failed to comply. And as it reported that it failed to comply, it started to report large amounts of money going missing. And so I was looking very much at the history of what's called black budget, which is money used by the federal government, which is not reported in their financials. And my work in that area as assistant secretary and later, I'd been the lead financial advisor for FHA, was looking into, you know, money disappearing and sort of odd things, funny things happening in the financials. So,
But I mean, money disappearing, meaning that this was actually money that had been funneled to the CIA or the NSA, and they didn't want to have a public accounting of it.
Well, let's go back through the history, because the history it really takes us back to World War II. After World War II, there were two laws passed. The first was the National Security Act in 1947, and then the CIA Act in 1949, and those two laws, in combination, created a provision whereby, through the National Security Council process, money could be clawed out of agency budgets and transferred into intelligence purposes. And what that did, Ian, was that created a financial mechanism, which is we're now, as part of what we're watching today, it created a financial mechanism whereby the U.S. government could borrow money and fund activities on a non-transparent basis. And then a third thing happened in 1980, which was by executive order. This is the beginning of Reagan-Bush. It was determined that corporations could do high-level secret military and intelligence functions. And so we put into place a system where we could borrow money all around the world using government credit and government securities backed by the taxpayers, spend that money in ways which were non-transparent and non-accountable, and through that mechanism fund very large corporations doing very secretive and powerful things.
Now, we know a little bit about that because some of those things have popped up in the news. We've talked to various security experts on this show who have talked about how certain communications companies had a CIA or an NSA computer essentially built into their own system, and they were siphoning off data directly as it was being gathered, and it was going in almost, you know, like went in one floor and then down secretly to another floor at the same time. Is it that kind of thing? Are we talking about funding private wars? I mean,
you're talking about financing operations, but you're also talking about financing market manipulation. Let me continue. I've described the financial mechanism, but what also happened is the federal government, because in some respects there really is no government as most people think of it, the federal government has as its depository the New York Federal Reserve Bank.
Right.
So we have and it's the New York Federal Reserve Bank is owned by its member banks. And those banks serve as the depository for the U.S. government. And so we have a situation where we have private banks who control the issuance of the currency, who are managing the government accounts. And then we, through the mechanism I just described, we've created information systems and accounting systems which are controlled by large corporations. And if you look back at the sort of banking and investment of those large corporations, it's pretty easy to intuit conceptually that it's the same people, you know, running both sides.
It's a kickback.
Well, you end up with a government that does not have financial or information sovereignty. And a government that does not have information or financial sovereignty is not a sovereign government, which is part of the situation we're looking at. Now, let me just add one piece. At the Treasury is a fund called the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is a fund managed by the New York Fed for the benefit directly for the Secretary of the Treasury. And that fund is given wide latitude to intervene in the markets. And what we've been watching since 1996, you'll often see references on financial websites or in the financial press to a policy called the strong dollar policy. And what we've been watching since 1996 is a policy that involves tremendous intervention in all the financial markets by what appears to be the Department of Treasury and the central banks, not just in America but all around the world. And what our show in 2005 was about was also the extent to which the black budget is not just, say, the clawing of monies from government budgets for secret purposes, but also operations. For example, you know, at one point we touched, I think, on CIA allegations of CIA drug dealing, but different operations like drug dealing and mortgage fraud and intervention in the financial markets in a way that generates profits for these operations. So you're seeing wide intervention in our world and our economy, you know, in covert ways, and that happens not just in, you know, in operations in everyday life, such as surveillance or financial fraud in your community, but it also occurs in terms of intervention in the manipulation of the stock and bond and precious metals and commodities and other markets.
All right, there's a lot there, and I kind of want to unpack some of that a little bit. So let me push back a little earlier in the timeline of what you talked about and say, so if I understand this right, this black budget, right, is siphoning off, borrowing money. Now, when you say that, do you mean borrowing money essentially from foreign powers, foreign governments, or do we borrow money from these agencies like we originally talked about, where suddenly millions or billions would go missing from a budget for a particular agency that was being used? Is it that kind of borrowing?
Well, let me step back and give a little bit of a framework. Think of our world. Have you ever been to Disney World?
Yes, I have many times.
Okay. Well, I've never been to Disney World, but I have a friend who took one of the management courses. In Disney World, there's this, you know, there's this lovely world above the ground. You know, it's
right,
kind of the overt world.
Exactly.
And then there's an entire universe below the ground. You know, I'll, for my metaphor, I'll refer to
right,
it as the covert world.
Where they control the robots from
where
downstairs.
Where they sort of manipulate and do all the things that make the overworld wonderful. But in the instance of the economy, you know, the high margin stuff is covert, and the overt stuff tends to be low margin. And over time, the people who control the covert cash flows end up, you know, buying, owning, and manipulating the overt world. And so if you want to get a clear picture of your world, if you want an integrated and sort of simple view of your world, you need to have a picture of the overt and the covert and how they interact.
So is there a list of the usual suspects of in the covert world that lurks down there in the...
Well, the funny thing about the covert world is, you know, this is everybody and everything. So in every neighborhood, there's an overt and a covert side. In every government agency or big organization, there tends to be an overt and a covert side. For example, you know, a lot of the covert, obviously, government is something that themes through all of this. But a lot of the covert stuff is done by, you know, by large government defense contractors of these banks that are depositories. And it's interesting, if you look at a socially responsible investment fund, you know, it's full of all the guys who are doing all of this. And that's because most people assume that these organizations are, you know, their overt side.
Well, I am the dumbest guy I know, Catherine Austin Fitz.
No,
I'm warning you right now. You're probably going to have to explain things a little bit more for me. But here in the back of the class, let me just say, can you give me like a name? Give me an example that you think is a fairly representative. Is it somebody as of the marquee value of a Halliburton, or is it, you know, somebody we would never expect, like Taco Bell or something like that?
Well, it's funny you pick franchises because.
Don't tell me Taco Bell is ruling the world.
No.
Okay.
I'll give you a perfect story because to help folks, you know, the way to understand everything is through one case study. If you can understand one case study, a lot of times you can understand these phenomena. And it was for this purpose that last year I published a story. You can link to it from our website at solari.com. It's called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Prison Profits.
Okay.
And one of the things it describes is the European Union lawsuit against RJR Nabisco. Now, just about everybody listening tonight has probably, you know, smoked or eaten an RJR Nabisco product. So this is a fairly, you know, this is a company that's fairly well known to most Americans. The European Union lawsuit was brought on behalf of the 11 sovereign nations of Europe. Sweden, France, Germany, you know, blah, blah, blah. And basically it alleged several decades of money laundering by RJR Nabisco, engineered at the highest levels with such characters as Saddam Hussein's family, the Italian mafia, the Russian mafia, Latin America drug cartels. And the motions, and we've put up on the website copies of the original legal motions that were filed in the Federal District Court in New York. The legal motions are a fabulous primer on different types of money laundering. You know, one of thousands of ways, you know, if you wanted to write a book on money laundering, it would be longer than The Joy of Cooking. There are that many recipes. But one of the ways to launder money is to sell, let's say you have $1 billion of mortgage fraud profits illegally gotten. You know, I can sell you cigarettes, and then you can proceed to import those cigarettes into your country and sell them. So one of the many schemes is cigarette sales. And they describe in this lawsuit these kinds of things. Now, the time at which this sort of one of the time periods covered by the lawsuit is when RJR was owned by KKR, which is one of the large private equity and leverage buyout firms.
Right.
And run by Lou Gerstner. Lou Gerstner, after KKR brought RJR Nabisco, they recruited Lou Gerstner over from American Express. Well, you know, these are the, if you read the financial press, these are the people who are the creme de la creme
right.
of, you know, the financial market. And it's interesting because I was a member of the board and a managing director of Dillon Reed, and we represented RJR Nabisco, and I talk all about this in the story, during the period when KKR won a bidding war to do a leverage buyout of RJR Nabisco. And the price just kept going up and up and up and up, and I couldn't fathom how they could pay back all this debt they were borrowing. It didn't make any sense. And then I read the RJR Nabisco lawsuit, and I said, oh, now I see where they got the cash to pay off all that debt. You know, this was an organized crime scheme. Now, why is this relevant, you know, to everyone listening tonight? To the extent that a stock and the stock market or the mortgage markets are pumped up with these kinds of non-transparent cash flows, in this case it was, you know, it was drug running, but there are plenty of other things, and mortgage fraud is a big one. But to the extent that, you know, my cigarette and cookie company is laundering money through a publicly traded stock, I can generate fantastic amounts of money for investors. I have an article about this called Narco Dollars for Beginners.
Right.
And the Dillon Reed article and the Narco Dollars is really designed for people, you know, who are not financial experts. Narco Dollars is more accessible, but then Dillon Reed takes you deep into the, you know, I pull up all the SEC documents and kind of walk you through the money and how one of these works. But let me describe the model, Ian, because I think that really helps and will help us understand the housing bubble.
Okay.
And do you know what a pump and dump is?
That's where this is this email kind of scam that goes around too, where they try to get a bunch of people to make an investment into a worthless stock, get it up by a dollar, but if you've got enough and you know when to get out, you can make millions just by getting out in time.
Well, a pump and dump, remember, you can
Is that wrong?
You've got it. A pump, okay. You can pump and dump anything.
Okay, but that's the email scam is a good example of that. Isn't that, I mean, aren't those classic
right.
pump and dumps that go on every day?
Yeah. You can
okay.
pump and dump a stock. You can pump and dump a house.
Right.
So you can pump and dump real estate. You can pump and dump a neighborhood. You can pump and dump a country. And what we're watching today for the first time that I know of in the history of civilization, you can pump and dump an entire planet.
Okay. You've just freaked me out there.
Okay, now, if you really
Who's behind the pump and dump of planet Earth?
Right? We're looking at the first complete planetary pump and dump. The Stanley, who was it? There's a wonderful movie, Barry Lyndon, by Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, sure, Barry Lyndon.
It describes this pattern by Irish, you know, it's from Thackeray's novel, but it describes the Irish aristocracy pumping and dumping things. And so, you know, I believe it's all in the movies, but that'll give you a good example. But here's how you do a pump and dump on a stock deal. Let's say we buy a publicly traded stock that's, you know, a company that's not doing particularly well. It's trading at $10.
Okay.
And we go to our friendly senators and congressmen and people in the administration, and we get a government contract.
Right.
And it raises the company's profits from $10 to $20.
Right.
And but since we've known that, we've bought the stock and we've borrowed money to do it from our friendly, you know, New York Fed member bank. And so we're, you know, we've bought the stock for a dollar. It goes up to $20. We've got a $10 profit on essentially, you know, an almost $0 investment. Now we sell our stock, we take our $10, and then we, you know, we request that our friend pull the contract. The stock drops back to $10. Meantime, we've shorted the stock, which means we sold the stock with stock that we borrowed, we don't own.
Right.
We short it, we sell it at 20, and then we cover when it drops at 10, we make another $10. So you make $10 going up, and you make $10 going down. If you've ever read or listened to any of my work on Enron,
sure.
It describes why I believe that there is a pump and dump on Enron. But
okay, well then here's what I want to hold on to. Uh-huh. I get that, and maybe I'm still just picturing Nabisco cookie products in my head, and that's why I sort of missed something here. But I want to go back to who's pumping and dumping the planet, too, and then how this ties in to the tapeworm economy and the mortgage industry next on Coast to Coast AM. I am just getting into this topic. Catherine Austin Fitz, it's fascinating. You can link up to her website through ours. We're talking about the tapeworm economy and this mortgage bubble that may or may not be about to burst. Who wants it to burst? Who's lined up with their hands open, ready to collect, ready to reap the benefits of what they have sown years ago? And who is behind all of this? We'll name the names. Catherine Austin Fitz has been tracking this story for a long time. She's got a lot to say about it. We'll get back to it next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so we've been talking with Catherine Austin Fitz about the sort of the black box economy of the United States and what we can see in the stories about this housing bubble. Again, I'm just going to go back a little bit to where we were, because I find this stuff so deep and dense and filled with so many leads and clues, and I'm just trying to follow them all. But you said earlier that the people who hold the paper, essentially, on our national debt, or on the bank, the Federal Reserve, that they have sort of they have a public face and a private face, no surprise there, and they have certain privileges that comes with the providence of that money, and those privileges allow them to manipulate the government and government agencies so that they get kind of a kickback if there's money that might be rerouted through the CIA to a private corporation to do, you know, work for clandestine work for the CIA. They do it through a private company, and suddenly hundreds of millions of dollars can go to one of these organizations that's providing the money.
It's not a secret at all. I had somebody ask me right after the war in Iraq started. It was when Halliburton was being investigated for criminal, the criminal investigation in Cheney's office related to the issuance of contracts in Halliburton. And so I went to Halliburton's website. I guess CBS MarketWatch said that Halliburton had $12 billion of contracts related to Iraq, $12 billion a year in revenues. And so I on a cost-plus contract, Ian, your profit margin is about 5 to 10%. And during that time, the rumors were that they were much, you know, the profit was much higher. But let's just take 10%. And so okay. The profit would have been $1.2 billion. And I went to Halliburton's website, and they were trading at a multiple of 12 times earnings, and their market value was $12 billion. And I realized, oh, my God, if there hadn't been an Iraq war, there might not be a Halliburton.
Well, I think this is let's use the Iraq war. I think this is great. So,
I mean, that's a perfect example of
that's a perfect example of
that country.
Okay, so
before
pumping
you have
a
to understand how you pump and dump a planet, you have to understand how you pump and dump a country and a neighborhood and a person and a family. And, you know, but that's war is one of, let's say you own a country.
Okay.
You know, in this instance, Iraq. If I come in and invade your country and take you over, the first thing I can do is I can make my citizens pay my company's money to throw you out. Okay, this is economic warfare. Now I own the country, right, and I can get my taxpayers to issue big contracts to help me, quote, fix up the country and bring democracy.
Right.
So I make money by, you know, destroying, you know, throwing you out and taking over and destroying everything.
Right.
And then I make money, you know, pumping it back up again.
But
this time I own it.
Yeah, but and the difference is, though, too, and this I think is a part of the story, is then you also make money over and over and over again as there's just enough of an insurgency that keeps breaking all the things we just built, so then we have to pay to build it all over again.
Right. I don't know enough about, you know, it's very hard to get really reliable information on what's happening in Iraq. And I think the scary thing on Iraq, because I don't think Iraq is going to turn out to be a typical pump and dump. I think the scary thing here is, you know, yes, we're using these patterns, but no, they're not working. So I think we've gotten ourselves into a little bit of a hole, but needless to say, you know, when you get yourself into a hole, the private parties can make a fortune. So a hole is not necessarily bad for them. It may be bad for the world and bad for Iraq and bad for Americans, but it's not bad for the guys making money on the hole.
No, that's what I was going to say. I mean, right. It seems like that's where we've already fixed infrastructure things, and then they keep getting blown up or burned down or whatever, and then we're back to fixing them again. And each time there's more money taken from the taxpayers' coffers to go pay for that.
Right. Well, but we've had for 50 years a construct of government contracting called cost plus, where the higher the contractor's cost, the more money they make. And obviously it doesn't take anybody any amount of time to figure out that's not a really wonderful incentive system, when in fact you can borrow a near infinite amount of money to finance that system. When you have, it's not surprising there's $3.3 trillion that's gone missing at the Department of Defense, because the same people who are getting the contracts and the purchases are also running the accounting and information systems.
Right. What's the end game here? I mean, if you were to look at this as a pump and dump, to look at Iraq as that, or to see this as, you know, similar to past patterns, what do you imagine might happen? How will this ever end?
Okay. Well, there are a couple of possibilities, but one. We know that we've had an investment model running the planet now for say 500 years at least, and I would call it central banking warfare, where you have a combination of people who can print money, and then they have the weaponry, to force the liquidity to keep working. So basically, you've got the ability to kill with impunity, and you've got the ability to print money. And it's that central banking warfare model that has really been the success. I mean, it's one of the reasons for the success of the English-speaking people and the people in the first world. And I'm not trying to say that there was everything that was bad about that model, but it's no longer working because with new technology, with globalization, with growth in the population, you're talking about something that's non-sustainable. You've used the expression, one of my expressions is the tapeworm economy.
Right.
That's where you have a small group of, I won't ask you, Ian, if you've ever had a tapeworm, but the way a tapeworm works in your body is...
Let me just say yes. Now go ahead.
it injects in you a chemical that makes you crave what's good for the tapeworm and what's bad
right.
for you. And, a tapeworm economy is where you have a small group of insiders who are centralizing political and economic power in a way that destroys wealth. I mean, when you go into a country and wreck everything and then spend a fortune doing it, fixing it up in a way which doesn't get you a wonderful place, you know, that's a huge amount of money and time and effort going to, you know, just create negativity. So you're shrinking total wealth in a way that makes you money. So all the outsiders suffer, but part of the key to that is the outsiders support the insiders.
Well, I like that metaphor, but tapeworms are a parasite, but that doesn't seem to me to be, I mean, I know every metaphor has its limitations, but that really it seems like the other way around. It's almost like as a host body, maybe the tapeworm is really in charge and always has been. It's not
right,
a parasite.
Right, the tapeworm is in charge, but it lives within us. You know, it lives within us, and we feed it. In other words, if the tapeworm could starve collectively, we have the power to starve the tapeworm. A few people can't possibly exercise this kind of centralized control unless the few support it.
Ever seen those ads for the early patent over the counter patent medicines that were essentially tapeworm eggs?
No.
You know what I'm talking about? There was a time when they used to sell tapeworm eggs as a weight loss product.
Oh wow.
And you would this is not even that long ago, oddly, and you would take it and you would intentionally ingest a tapeworm to as a weight loss. And I wonder to even take that same idea, how many people, if they really knew that this was a tapeworm economy, still wouldn't care?
Well, let me tell you a story. In the summer of 2000, I was speaking to a wonderful group of people. I gave a speech called Spiritual Foundation International in Philadelphia. And it was about 100 people who were dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, and they meet once a year to talk about how they could help do that. And a friend of mine had asked me to give them a speech called How the Money Works on Organized Crime. And we were in the middle of it talking about the CIA allegations of CIA drug dealing in South Central L.A. And you can read all about that in the Dylan Reed story I just described. And so someone had, a spokesperson for the Department of Justice had told a reporter I was working with at the time that the U.S. economy launders $500 billion to $1 trillion of all illegal monies, making us the worldwide leader. And I said to this wonderful audience of spiritually committed people, what would happen if the United States government, you know, and the United States financial system stopped being the global money laundering leader? So we had a little interactive discussion, and they said, well, you know, we need to borrow money to finance the government. So, you know, our government spending would slow down, or our taxes might go up, or our government checks might stop, and that money would go to the Hong Kong and Singapore and Australian stock market, so it wouldn't come to the New York stock market, so our mutual funds would go down. And so I said to them, okay, well, let's pretend there's a big red button on up here on the lectern, and if you push that button, you can stop all, you know, all hard narcotics trafficking in your neighborhood, your county, your town, your country tomorrow, all stop, you know, all stupid war on drugs efforts stop by, you know, whatever den of your imagination, you know, thus offending the people who control the $500 billion to a trillion, who here will push the button. And out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, guess how many would push the button?
I don't have any idea.
One. So I said to the other 99, why would you not push the button? And they said, we don't want our mutual funds to go down.
There you go.
And we don't want our taxes to go up. And we don't want our government checks to stop.
Well, that answers that question. Then, using that as a focus group, the majority of people would be okay with a tapeworm economy, even if that's what they, even if they called it that. Let's say we got rid of.
But you know, what we didn't realize, and it came out in that discussion, is there is a way to turn the red button green, which is, you know, the question we need to ask is, how can we make money pushing the red button? Because if we can do it, then we can push the red button. And let me say it another way. We are currently living an unsustainable lifestyle. And so part of getting out of this trap, getting out of the tapeworm economy and sort of the fever of it, is rather than liquidating our wealth to support our lifestyle, why don't we start to change how we organize our lifestyle, how we apply new technology to a more sustainable way of living? Because
now, you say our wealth, you mean our national wealth as opposed to our individual wealth?
No, I mean our individual wealth. And I'll give you a perfect example.
Okay.
I once did an audio seminar called Beyond Socially Responsible Investing, where I was talking about the extent to which the socially responsible investment funds are investing in all the companies behaving in this way and doing these various things. And my aunt listened to it and called me up. She's a very active peace activist, very opposed to the war in Iraq. And she said, you know, what you're saying is a social index fund that she was investing in is invested in Halliburton. And she said, I can't possibly be, you know, that can't be true. And I said, it is. And she asked me to go through her portfolio. Well, she had three mutual funds investing in Halliburton. So we are, you know, when you say who's doing this, if you look at our bank deposits, our purchases, our investments, if you walk around your neighborhood or look at the organizations that you support, whether it's your university, it's your church, we're all financing this. And the minute you stop and say, well, you know, who's doing this and how can we stop them, you know, you need to look at your own financial situation and your own, you know, who you support in a variety of different ways. And what more often than not you'll do is you'll find out, oh my heavens, it's me. I'm financing this, you know, because I will tell you, as an ethical matter, I think where our money goes, I'm responsible not just for my actions, what I do, but I'm also responsible for where my money goes and the actions that it finances in my name.
Well, I love that thought. So, I mean, again, going back to turning that red button green, how do we then individually and then by extension collectively, how do we avoid feeding the beast?
Excellent. That's That's where we need to be. Now, let me tell you a story. In 1989, when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, my staff, and we were looking at tremendous defaults and foreclosures all across the country, my staff pointed out to me that we had one town in New Mexico where 70% of the mortgages were in default and owned by FHA, Fannie, and Freddie. And I said to them, look, why don't you have the town buy the mortgages? And they said, well, the town doesn't have any money. And I said, well, I'm from Wall Street. You know, we buy and sell companies all the time, and we don't have any money. We use other people's money.
Right.
So I said, just tell them to create a stock entity. I don't know if it should be a trust or a REIT or whatever, but create a stock entity, and we'll swap them the mortgages for stock. And they looked at me like I was mad. Well, during that period, we had the same kind of credit crunch that we saw emerging in the last week or two. And as that credit crunch happened, Ian, all the small businesses and small farms experienced tremendous decreases in the amount of lending available to them. Okay, now, if I could go back in a time machine in 1989, I wouldn't have been the Assistant Secretary of Housing. I would have started to persuade everybody locally, as well as everybody who had troubled mortgages, to pool their capital and buy up and reposition investments in that place. Because what you're talking about at the root is we have 74,000 neighborhoods in the United States. I don't know what the number of counties is off the top of my head. But in every county in the country, what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to turn that red button green county by county by county. And part of that is reengineering government credit and investment within that place to start to significantly improve the productivity of small businesses, of families, of individuals in the face of a devastating amount of foreclosures and troubled mortgage financing.
I think this is probably a good time for me to disclose that I have a sister-in-law who's kind of a muckety-muck at Fannie Mae.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if that has anything to do with the conversation, but I just thought I'd say that.
What you're going to find is this is like a swimming pool. The housing bubble started in the mid-90s. It didn't, lately I've been reading that it started in 2001. That's not true. It started in the mid-90s. And it has been a fever which has engulfed everybody and everything. So every one of us and our family and friends and networks are deeply involved. There is no they. This truly is us.
Well, without naming names on my sister-in-law, she used to say something I thought was really interesting every time I talked to her about it. Her big concern was China and how much paper China holds on the United States.
Right.
Now, that's sort of public information, right? I mean, China, even as recently as a few weeks ago, sort of threatened if they didn't get what they wanted from the United States, they might just mess around with our economy, and they can. I mean, they could do a lot. So I want to ask you about that when we come back, and then I want to get more into some of the people. I really want to kind of go through the usual suspects maybe on this current housing crunch. I love the story about what you saw coming back in 1995,
right,
and what you were told when you asked about it back then. And then I want to see a little bit more, too, on this tapeworm economy, which I think is a fascinating way of looking at it, and the number of people who are benefiting from it right now and who is lined up to benefit from it more in the future. We'll get into all of that. Can't wait for your questions, too, coming up an hour from now. For Catherine Austin Fitz, former Assistant Secretary of Housing and a commissioner as well under Bush 1, on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Talking with Catherine Austin Fitz, and I think this is one of my favorite types of Coast to Coast shows. We're talking about something that we see every day, but then flipping it over and examining the soft white underbelly and exactly what it is that we can expect from this tapeworm economy next. Did I just mix my metaphors? I think I did. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. By the way, if you miss crypto news, you can link onto that at our website at coasttocoastam.com. Just look for my blog tab there in the lower left-hand corner of the screen. Catherine Austin Fitz taking over in 1989 in the Housing Department as Assistant Secretary. By the way, should I be calling you Madam Secretary or something like that? Okay. When did you become aware of? I mean, is there a timeline to your discovery of how much money laundering was going on in the government, the great extent of this tapeworm economy?
The first thing that happened to me when I became Assistant Secretary is I called in the person in charge of the budget because I'd read the laws, and the laws said that I, as commissioner, had sole fiduciary responsibility for $300 billion of mortgage insurance, and most of that was required by law to be run on a self-supporting basis. So we had to charge premiums for our mortgage insurance sufficient to cover our expenses. And so I was required to make sure we were doing that. So I asked for the financials, and he said, well, we don't have financials, but I'll give you the budget. And the budget went from about, the floor halfway to the ceiling, and it was so thick. And I read it four times and called him back in, and I said, nowhere in here does it say if we're making or losing money. And he said, we were originating at the time about $50 to $100 billion a year of mortgage insurance. And I said, well, where can I get the information as to whether we're making or losing money? And he said, well, the accountants have that. And I said, well, where are the accountants? I want to talk to them. And he said, they report to another assistant secretary, and you're not allowed to speak to them.
What? What? Hello? What? Why not?
I said, well, that's going to change. And I lobbied the White House and the secretary's office. It took 3 months. I got the accountants moved over to report to me, and it turned out that we were losing $11 million a day in the single-family fund. So I said to the accountants, well, where? We have 10 federal regions and 80 field offices. Where are we losing the money? And they said, well, we don't keep that information. So I said, you mean the field offices don't know how much they're making or losing? They said, no, they don't know. And I said, well, look, we mail out checks. We have zip codes. This is an emergency. I want place-based information.
Right.
It shows me by place how much we're making or losing. So it turned out they came back and did a crash thing, came back, and it turned out we're making and losing, or making money in eight regions and losing 100% plus more in two. One of those regions was the Texas region, which included Arkansas. And the other was the Colorado region. So I called the head of the Texas region, who is really one of our finest field office regional managers. And I said, Sam, how much do you think you lost last year? I said, how do you think you're doing? He said, oh, I think we're breaking even. And I said, well, you lost $2 billion last year. I'm faxing the cash flow estimates down, and I'm flying down. I'll be down tomorrow to talk about, what we're going to do about this.
Right.
But he didn't even know. And so that's, when I became a big believer in much better accounting and reporting and place-based information, on particularly on government credit and spending. And
okay.
Then what you'll see if you read the Dylan Reed story is the history of the federal government really can be told not by the thing that goes wrong, but all the people who were run out of government when they try to implement the things that we all know we need if this is not going to happen. In other words, we knew my job was to clean up the last housing bubble, and I and a group of people implemented everything you need to have in place to make sure it can't happen again. And that group of people was run out, so that it could happen again.
Well, what happened when you flew down to see Sam? What happened when you got down there? Did you fix the problem?
Absolutely. It's real funny. I got down to Fort Worth, and Sam and the team had gone off into sort of, a back room outside the office. They called in the field office managers and already come with a game plan with everything they had to do. We instituted audited financial statements, and OMB picked up on it and instituted it government-wide, which is how the reports have now come out about all the money missing. That's how we know it. And, but I was fired by Jack Kemp, probably 6 to 12 months later. I'd have to go back and look at the exact time. But essentially, I, like most clean officials, ran into trouble trying to get the financial pieces of the government to run on a transparent basis in accordance with law. I mean, we have, as part of the Constitution, you're not allowed to spend money that is not appropriated by Congress. But we now have a situation where we're spending significant amounts of money not appropriated by Congress. If you go to my website, there's a tremendous amount about the missing money. It's now coming out there's missing money in Iraq, but this is basically illegal. In 2002, I went to visit with, it was 2000, I went to visit with the chief of staff to the appropriation chair of the committee overseeing HUD on the Appropriations Committee. And they said to me, what do you think is going on at HUD? And I said, I was in the process of trying to get my company paid. And I said, I don't know, what do you think is going on? And they looked at me and said, HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise. And I said, I don't disagree.
Okay, and as a criminal enterprise, meaning what? I mean, I understand the sketch of it, but...
Meaning that the financial operations are not being run in accordance with law. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
In fiscal 1998, so that was beginning in October 1997, HUD reported $17 billion missing. And then the following year, $59 billion. It had $59 billion of undocumentable adjustments, and the inspector general just refused to produce financial statements and audit, and just said it can't be done, and refused. And moreover, never got to the bottom of where the $59 billion was, how much was missing, where it was, who got it. Now that's not legal. You can't spend money according to the Constitution unless it's been appropriated by Congress.
Where did that $59 billion go?
Well, no one knows.
I mean, where would you guess it went? Who's likely to get a piece of that $59 billion?
Well, I'll give you my best guess as to where it went. In 1997, I made a presentation to top pension fund leaders and advisors, really sort of a wonderful group of people. And we had, my company, Hamilton Securities Group, have been for years prototyping how we could turn this around, how we could get the economy to be much more productive. We were concerned that the U.S. economy was losing productivity. And so the question was, how could we do it? And what we realized was that government money was increasingly being spent and organized to generate stock market profits for big companies as opposed to fundamental productivity. And so we had sort of a vision on how you could re-engineer government investment by place in a way that would really significantly improve productivity and would generate significant long-term profits for pension funds, which was important because we needed the pension funds to do well to support retirees. And in the middle of the presentation, the head of CalPERS, which is the largest equity, as largest pension fund in the country, it's one of the California public employees funds, said to me, "You don't understand. It's too late." And I said, "What do you mean it's too late?" And he said, he didn't say who they was. He said, "They have given up on the country. And they are moving all the money out of the country starting in the fall. They're moving it all to Asia." And what he was describing was the process of taking capital out of one economy where productivity is falling and the population is aging and moving it to areas of the world where the economy is much more dynamic and productivity is rising. And I thought he meant that they were moving money that could be legally moved. And now what I believe is that we bubble the economy with a variety of different kinds of debt, one of which was the housing and mortgage bubble debt, and proceeded to pull significant amounts of all capital that could be pulled, including out of the government, and simply moved it into investment abroad. Mm. And I think the $4 trillion pulled out during that time period was simply capital being pulled out of the U.S. economy. Now, if we had tried to pull that money out without bubbling the housing, without having the housing bubble and consumer and government debt bubble, you know, people would have started screaming. They would have noticed the liquidity going out of the system and the capital going out of the system. They didn't notice because we were awash in debt. Now, one of the interesting questions is, if we pull $4 trillion out of the U.S. economy, move it and invest it in Asia and the emerging markets, and those markets are buying treasury securities that finance the money that we're pulling out.
Right.
It's a big circle. You know, Dick Cheney once said deficits don't matter, and the reality is, if you have the satellite systems and the invisible weaponry that, you know, we're said to have, and the black budget weaponry that we're said to have, then, you know, in theory, you can force the world to keep buying treasury securities and finance this infinitely.
Well, first of all, I mean, do you believe that? I mean, you just said about forcing the world.
I believe that it is theoretically possible to continue.
Yeah, I get the theory, but I mean, do you believe that that's what's happening?
Yeah, I believe that the reason, you know, if the U.S. dollar marked to market, it would trade, you know, the price of gold. If you mark the U.S. currency to market, the price of gold would probably be at $2,000 or $3,000. You know, I think we have put into place both the surveillance and harassment technology, the promise software kind of technology to hack, you know, hack systems, whether they're the systems that fly planes or the systems that settle banks. And I think we have the, you know, the electromagnetic weaponry, so that a few people can enforce their will worldwide in ways that permit incredible financial responsibility. So, yeah, no, I think it is in theory possible to keep doing this. Now, what it's going to require is depopulation, because as the tapeworm needs more subsidy to keep the game going, they extract it in a way that causes productivity to drop, at which point you need to extract more, and, you know, it's a downward spiral.
No. What do you mean by depopulation?
Well, I think you have a non-sustainable system. And so if you're going to sustain it, then you need to either change to a sustainable system, or you need to, you know, to extract the subsidy from life. So whether it's war, whether it's plagues, whether it's poverty, you need to the non-productive needs to steal to support its habit. So, I mean, that's exactly how a body grows weak from having a tapeworm.
So you would anticipate that there would be some form of an engineered massive kill-off of the population.
No, so, I think in these situations it can be very slow and steady in most places.
But when you say plague, I mean, that usually has that's a pretty quick arc.
Well, no, but because with AIDS, we've been watching a plague worldwide for two decades now.
Yeah, but then you've got that other industry out there that is creating the drugs that essentially makes AIDS not nearly as much of a factor. For example, in the United States,
right?
It's become a non-factor, really, in terms of life expectancy in many ways. So. Well, I'm fascinated by what you're saying. I'm just trying to have a better understanding. So the creation of wars then perhaps to reduce the population.
Well, one thing to understand is that we're deeply dependent. You know, our economy in the first world is deeply dependent on war. We have, I think the last time I looked, about $1 trillion of purchases, sales, contracts related to the military. So we've got about $1 trillion of expenditures. I don't know what the current DOD budget is, but I think it's up to about $500 billion. So you have an entire infrastructure of corporations and employees and entities whose business it is to make war. And of course, the problem with that is things grow more centralized. Is who are you going to make war on? How are you going to create an enemy?
In a globalized economy, yes, where everybody's interdependent.
Right. We have almost a trillion. We have $500 billion to $1 trillion of economic power that can't seem to find Osama bin Laden.
Right.
One guy.
Right.
So we're having trouble coming up with enemies. Not to say, and you know, of course, the danger is we've got more and more powerful weaponry, and you're in a situation where, you know, one person or a small group of people without that much resources can make a weapon that can destroy millions. So it's tricky business.
Is that why we're having a war on terror, which is a sort of non-geographically located sort of a conceptual war? Because you can't have an actual enemy anymore?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I mean, if you look at one of my favorite expressions of the health and well-being of a place is the popsicle index.
Right.
And the popsicle index is the percent of people in a place who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. So when I was a little girl growing up in West Philadelphia, the popsicle index was 100%. It was unthinkable that a child wasn't free to just roam. Now, if you track the popsicle index going down in my old neighborhood, and today it's probably, if you ask one of, you know, the people who lived in the home I grew up in, it's probably about 10%.
Right.
You'd never let a child just walk anywhere in that neighborhood without supervision. So as the popsicle index has gone steadily down, we've spent steadily more and more money for government to keep the popsicle index up. And there's almost a direct correlation between the more you spend for enforcement and a variety of things to get the popsicle index up, the more it goes down. And in fact, I don't think those are unrelated, although, you know, it's a whole show to talk about that. But
No, I get that the one funds the other. So in order to keep the war on, you know, scary monsters up, you have to be decreasing the faith that people have that they're actually winning it.
Right, and part of it is centralization. The more you centralize economic and political control, and the more intimacy stops. I mean, one of the reasons my neighborhood was very safe when I was a child was if somebody behaved badly, you know, all the sort of hot, you know, hardworking, responsible people would get together, conspire, and figure out a way to cut off their money or, you know, get them in trouble. But now with all the economic and governmental activities in that community centralized into, you know, something much higher, it's much harder for people in that place to get together and figure out, you know, how to exercise some kind of responsibility.
And that's why we're going to have more wars on crabbiness or wars on ennui or...
Well, you know, because I continue to be an optimist. I mean, the more you understand about how the system really works, the more you see the opportunity to change if people can see, see the ways in which they can exercise power. Let me give you an example. I think one of the biggest $64 questions, because what we're watching in the housing market right now, Ian, is the central bank's bailout the unproductive players in a way that's going to make it tougher for the productive players.
All right. Well, I need you to hang on to that example, and we'll come back to that. Don't forget where you are. And also, I want to get back to China, too, because I really am curious to see what foreign governments own how much of us and what are the implications of that for our economy. Next with Catherine Austin Fitz on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking with Catherine Austin Fitz, and I want to get back to something here just a second and just remind you again, your phone call is coming up at the top of the hour. I know there's so many different interesting ways you might want to go with this, but I'm going to ask her about the North American Union proposal, plus about her thoughts on NAFTA, as well as China, as well as what she was just talking about, and remind her, too, that I'll be on tomorrow night, too, on Coast to Coast AM special Sunday night edition. Stand by, because we still haven't gotten to all that is going on. Reading between the lines of the stories that we see on the front page of the papers of this big housing bubble, and who's really behind it, who's going to benefit from it more on naming names on that, too, coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Catherine Austin Fitch, former assistant secretary under the Bush 1 administration. So you were going into an example, and it was just getting to the really meaty part.
Right now we're watching and the unproductive drain the productive. And I think the $64 question is whether the productive sector of the economy is going to reassert itself. Let me give you an example of what I mean by that. Under the law, Ian, if I encourage you to borrow money, when I know that your job is going to be transferred, or I know your income is going to fall because as a large bank have access to that information and you don't, then that is potentially called fraudulent inducement. In other words, I have failed to disclose to you material information important to your ability to service that debt that I have and you don't. And so if I fail to disclose, that debt may have been fraudulently induced, at which point you may not owe me the money. You may not owe some or all. Now, what we're watching is a situation where a significant amount of the mortgages in this country since 1996, are potentially those which could be determined by a court of law to be fraudulently induced. Now, let's add to that situation, many of those mortgages were put into pools, and those pools created securities that were then sold to institutions all over the world. It's pretty clear that many of the companies who pooled and sold those securities knew that they were not as strong as they were presented to be. That is also potentially fraud or fraudulent inducement.
So this adds to this perception of it being an illegal operation, too.
Right.
I mean, every level.
We have a situation where a variety of courts all over the world could ultimately turn to the middlemen and bankers who've engineered this and say, nobody owes you money, but you owe the investors you sold these securities to a lot of money. And so the question is, so on both sides of the market, we have a fair amount of productive people, and in the middle, we have a fair amount of unproductive people who've engineered this. And the real question is, are the productive people going to turn and squeeze out the middlemen?
And by unproductive, you mean the people who are manipulating it, who actually don't produce anything themselves. They make money by making certain events happen.
Right. And let me give you an example, because I think stories really help. At the end of the last housing bubble, when I left the administration, I became a member of the board of Sallie Mae, which is it's the Fannie Mae of student loans.
Okay.
And there were seven bank vice chairmen on the board, and it was interesting. At board meetings, our big question was, Citibank was essentially bankrupt. Would the Federal Reserve shut them down, or would it, under the too-big-to-fail doctrine, would it somehow save them yet again? They'd lost so much money on real estate loans as a result of the real estate bubble in the 80s. And what proceeded to happen is what we're watching happen, we've watched happen many times. The Fed started to lend money in the short market at low rates, and the banks could borrow both from the Fed and in a variety of ways, money at very low rates, and proceed to buy Treasury securities at huge profits. So, for example, during that period, I had a lunch with one of the bankers from one of the banks that was solvent. They had $110 billion of Treasuries on their balance sheet, which they were financing at a cost of capital that was 5.5% less, and they were generating $6 billion a year from just borrowing in the short market and lending back to the Treasury in the long market. Now, let me explain what this means if you're a taxpayer. Why did the taxpayers need to give the banking system their credit? Because they're using FDIC insurance. We're guaranteeing it to do this. So we're giving them our credit to raise the capital, and then they're using that to loan it back to us at 550 basis point higher. So we're giving them our credit. They're using it to raise our deposits at 3%, and then we're borrowing our own money back, you know, at 8.5% and paying taxes to support that. Well, that one bank was making about $6 billion a year, but we proceeded to float, you know, Citibanks and all the troubled banks, you know, back up into profitability. Now, here's why this is important. Let's say you and I are competitors, and every time you make a mistake, you get tailed out through the back door, and every time I make a mistake, I have to pay for it. Now, meantime, if you do something right, you get to keep the profits. You don't have to pay back your bailout. But every time I, you know, and every time I do well, I get to, you know, instead use that money to finance, you know, the costs of my losses from the last mistake.
Right.
Well, it doesn't take very long to figure out who's going to end up owning whom, right?
Right.
Well, because you have a get-out-of-jail-free card for all your mistakes.
And stories are helpful, and I am the dumbest guy I know, so...
No, I don't think so.
So stories with bunnies are particularly helpful, especially if the bunnies are wearing jackets and pants. So just help me understand that last part there.
Well,
so
who's
the person, who's the one that's getting the bailout and who's the one that isn't? I mean, if you had to put like a name to it, who's getting that backdoor bailout and who's the one that's being penalized for playing by the rules?
Okay, the guys last week, the guys who were getting the bails out were the guys who couldn't finance or needed to finance their positions in the mortgage markets. So it was Goldman Sachs, it was Bear Stearns, it was the big New York Fed banks. You know, if you want a list of who's really doing this, if you go to my website at Solari.com, we have a section at Solari.com/banks where we have a list of the top 20. We call them the Tapeworm 20, the 20 largest banks. The list is as of 2004. Those banks had profits that year of $89 billion, and American households had deficits of $342 billion. And that's a tapeworm when they're making money while you're losing money.
Right.
So
right.
All of American households are losing $342 billion, and they've got $89 billion of profits.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I have a question there, but I can go back to it. So if you had to wrap up, I can understand.
And it's important to understand it's those same banks that are running the government's accounts. And that's important because, let's say the average American household, when I did those numbers, was paying about $5,400 in federal taxes. Well, if you look at the amount of money that's disappearing when we talk about the missing money from the federal government, you know, it's about $5,000 a year. I mean, it's a big chunk of what everybody's paying in taxes. So these guys are making $89 billion while we're losing to $342 billion, but we're also paying another, you know, say $1.2 trillion that year, or $1.2 or $1.6 trillion of federal taxes, and a lot of it's disappearing out the back door, you know, of the guys who are managing the federal accounts. That kind of money can't leave unless your banker executes the transactions.
Is the Tapeworm 20 the people who are they behind moving this money into Asia? Are they
That's the $64 question. Who is the they? But what is important to understand as a matter of accountability is the banks who execute those transactions are accountable for executing illegal transactions no matter who they are.
Okay.
So, to give you an example, there's one theory of law, in fact, that I've been involved in litigating with the federal government, where the federal government says a government contractor is responsible financially for the opportunity costs of a financial transaction which didn't turn out as well as it ought to. Under that theory of law, you know, if there's $4 trillion missing, then the depository banks are responsible to return it, you know, no matter who they are and no matter where it went. So absolutely. I mean, if you had a company, Ian, that was engaged in illegal transactions, your bank would just shut you off and refuse to make them. So there's no reason that the federal government could, I mean, if a company operated without filing its audited financial statements with the you know, with the SEC and the New York Stock Exchange and the stock exchanges would shut it down. So what we're watching is an illegal operation that continues to function, you know, and yet the bankers and all the parties involved continue to execute the transactions. And the question is, can we, you know, can we enforce accountability, which gets us back to the red button problem. If you became president in the United States tomorrow, what everybody in America wants from you is their check. And to get their check, you have to turn around and borrow money from people all over the world, including the people who now control $500 billion to $1 trillion of, you know, illegal money laundering. And so you have to do whatever you have to do to raise that capital. And then the question really becomes, you know, how much coercion and force do you need to persuade countries around the world and institutions around the world to take your paper?
Well, that brings it back to the China question. Then.
Right.
Is that why so much? As I understood it, China was voluntarily buying our paper because it gives them leverage into our economy. We want them to buy our paper because then that makes us a less attractive takeover target, and that China continues to grow, ironically, you know, as a capitalistic power around the world, so that they might someday be able to affect what they could never do under communism, they could do under capitalism.
And right. Well, they finance the U.S. government. The U.S. government writes many checks to people all over the country, subsidies and contracts of various kinds, and they use that money then go to Walmart and buy things that were made in China. And that's part of how you go. But what you're doing is you're transferring your intellectual capital of how to build and make things to China in a way that ultimately continues to reduce productivity here in the country. So it's a cycle that keeps the economy going, but it's one that, you know, again, like a tapeworm, is draining you steadily.
Meanwhile, they're selling us Matchbox toys painted with lead paint. That were ordered by a U.S. manufacturer. I mean, I guess it sort of seems like it would be in their best interest, China's best interests, I don't know. You tell me. I mean, maybe China's not the only one. I mean, who else is doing it if it's not China?
Well, let's go back. We have a process where we're centralizing political and economic power. And rather than have a coup d'etat, I mean, rather than stand up and announce, look, we don't like doing it this way. We're going to change to a different, you know, technology is changing. The world is changing. We want to centralize and run it in a much more high-tech feudal, you know, like high-tech feudalism. The world's not sustainable, so the most unsustainable population in the world is the middle class of the United States. We're just going to stop, you know, we're going to reduce everybody to a much more modest way of living. Rather than have that conversation and decide it by a vote, you simply just do it. You know, you engineer it through a financial coup d'etat, and that's part of what we're watching. Now, most of the people involved don't see it clearly. They don't understand, you know, what's going on and how it works. What we do all know, Ian, is that if you look at our neighborhoods, you know, because the way to see this is to see it in the world in which you walk around and live.
Right.
In the average American household, I had a member of our Action Network who would take the Bureau of Economic Analysis statistics and reconfigure them, and what it showed year after year was the average American household had $5,000 more a year in expenses than they had revenues, and were borrowing that money, usually using their home, you know, or liquidating their assets. I mean, it got so bad in the county and where I live, you know, we have a place in the county seat where people can come and sell their possessions out of the back of their cars. They can't have a yard sale because they don't have a house. So, you know, we have car sales. But so you either borrow more or you liquidate your assets. But the liquidation of our equity has, whether it's, you know, in my family or in my neighborhood, has been going on steadily. And we've all been watching it. And so I think the question is, when is it that we're going to organize to change things? Because what we're experiencing is a marketplace where anything goes. In other words, it was very hard for most people to fathom 10 years ago that as a practical matter, they couldn't trust anything made by a large centralized organization, whether it was a company or a government. They couldn't imagine that they were literally a target for, and certainly in the financial area, if you sit at home during the day and you're a sophisticated financial person and you just listen to all the calls you get from credit card or other companies,
right.
And these are very predatory practices. They're just lying and they're very good at it. So it was very hard for people to fathom that you weren't a customer, you were a target. But I think we're making the change, and the question is, when are we going to start organizing and withdraw our support from the people who are killing us and organize to shift it to the people who can, best represent us and build us up?
Well,
that's the $64 question.
And I like to think that could happen, but I guess to focus better on where I started as opposed to how my question sort of fizzled out is when it comes to China and the United States, is it fair to ask who's pumping and dumping whom? I mean, is it a mutual pump and dump? Is what I'm getting from you is that there are no national lines?
There are no national lines.
Okay, there are no national lines.
The financial system is managed globally. And much of what happens in the United States is not decided. You know, it's a global group that's looking at the money. So if you try and explain the world in terms of sovereign nation states, it doesn't fit because you're really not looking at the equivalent of sovereign nation states.
Who are we looking at? Are we talking about Goldman Sachs and these other people,
I think in terms of global management, you're looking, if you look at the Bank of International Settlements, which is the central bank to the central bank, and you look at the central banks and the G8 system, which is the, central banks and treasuries from the first world countries, that the banking bureaucracy through the central banks and is the key, sort of the key bureaucracy that implements monetary policy and lending policies, credit policies worldwide. That's the banking system. If you want to look at who owns the equity, that's always been the $64 question.
Yeah, well, we're racking up a few of those. So who? Well, I tell you what, I'll come back. That'll be the question we'll start with, and then we'll give the numbers too. And I'm writing this down because I don't want to forget. Who owns the equity in the international bank that owns the Federal Reserve Bank, the banks that comprise the Federal Reserve? And we'll start there. And I also want to get back to that NAFTA question and the NAU question, too, just to see what Catherine Austin Fitz would say to that and all of your questions and comments coming up. We'll give you the numbers. Does this just get more fascinating with every passing minute, or is it just me? I'm overwhelmed, but I'm nowhere near stopping on Coast to Coast AM. Talking with Catherine Austin Fitz, who started tripping over the trillions that were being laundered within the government as she was the assistant secretary in the housing department, and has continued to watch the story and then to investigate the economy, which I guess could be summed up by, if you're just tuning in right now, and I would really recommend you go back and listen to the first couple of hours if you're a stream linker or if you can join and go back and listen to it, because it's all about black budgets, gold deposits, and the career of red buttons. And we'll let the rest of it, describe itself. But it came up to that very important question of who owns the equity in the international umbrella organization that controls the banks that provide the money for the Federal Reserve. And I got to ask you, I know that I'm asking a lot of you, but, are we talking – there. Does that where we put that right squarely at the feet of the history's greatest secret societies? Are we talking about the Bilderbergers? Are we talking about, I mean, who's the they there?
Well, if you study it, it's a combination of those things. It's funny. I once called and wrote, emailed or called all the Federal Reserve banks around the country and said to them, who owns your equity? And they all responded, our members. And so I said, well, which members and in what amount? And they said, well, that's confidential. And then I asked what I think is the more important question. I said, who manages the databases? Who manages all the data of the flows of money that come in and out of the Federal Reserve banks? And who has access to the data? And do the members and their owners have access to that data? Because I'll tell you, Ian, if I have data of all the economic flows in the economy, both for the banking system and by places, then I don't need any money. I can simply own everything eventually, particularly if you can print currency, as we're watching in the markets. So they said, well, that's confidential information.
And so whoever can look at that, I mean, those are the most powerful people on the planet. But I fear I'm going to go back to, and I'm going to look at my email, and there's going to be, 10,000 emails of people saying, it's the Jews, I've been telling you all along, I mean, or it's the Vatican, or it's the, and it's going to bring out all of these.
Well, in fact, I think if you look, what you're looking at ultimately, because the banking system, think of the whole planet like a house. You have your mortgage,
right.
You have the equity, and then you have the insurance, because we haven't talked about the insurance industry, but everybody knows your equity is worth nothing unless you have really good insurance. So part of this is the banking system, which we've been talking about. Part of it is the insurance system, which we haven't talked about. And then there's the equity. And if you look to, as far as I can tell, the most significant, what we're talking about is intergenerational pools of capital, of which the networks in and behind the Vatican are certainly one of the most significant. The religious orders have traditionally had. I mean, if you have diplomatic immunity and don't have to pay taxes globally, imagine how much you can accumulate after 2,000 years. So, but the reality, I think, is you're looking at a system that is not transparent and which has, it's been possible to manipulate. The biggest problem, and you see this, if you've ever sat on a board of directors or run a government agency, which I have, and you try and argue for the ethical thing, you run into the problem that the crowd always supports the guy who does the unethical thing that makes a bunch of money. And so you have a real prisoner's dilemma if you're in the leadership. How do you get the crowd to support you in doing that which is financially responsible? And the answer is since I've participated in leadership in a variety of forms is you can't. The crowd always votes in our society almost always votes for the criminal. And as they vote for the criminal and the criminal can buy up more technology and media, I mean, we literally have a very negative dynamic between organized crime, giving people everything they want in the short run in a way that destroys us in the long run. So I hate to bring up the story of the crucifixion, but it's not inappropriate. It was the crowd that voted to crucify Jesus. Wasn't the Romans. The Romans got the crowd to support them. The crowd voted to let the criminal go free. I have a wonderful audio seminar called Where Would Jesus Bank? And, and I talk about the fact that it's 2,000 years later and the crowd is still supporting the criminal. So, if you look at, it's very interesting, if you ever go to a peace rally, you'll see everybody, saying that they don't want war in Iraq. But if you look at their back pockets, they all have credit cards, from all the banks who are financing all of this and are running the government that way. And if you ever suggest that they switch to a local community bank, they say, well, I don't want to pay the ATM fees. And I once said to an activist, I said, look, the missing money is 14 $1,000 per American. And, you know, and if you're going to continue to bank at those banks just because they get you, you know, you get $25 a year lower in ATM fees, then you're losing $14,000 to get $25. You don't know how to price this correctly. So it's, you know, we are complicit in all of this. There's no way a housing bubble this big and this bad can go on without all of us participating in one form or another.
Well, just to answer your question that you asked a minute ago, no, I've never been asked to be on a board of directors. And and now we know why, too, because I am...
No, because
this is really interesting, and I am learning a ton. I am making a million notes, and I still can't get to all of them, but we'll open the door up for some other people to get in with their questions and comments coming up next. And then I want to save a couple of these things that I've jotted down, because this is changing the way I'm looking at the world tonight, and you're hearing it live on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Catherine Austin Fitz taking your questions and comments, and looking forward to exploring one or two things yet left this hour. But first, East of the Rockies, Lewis has been waiting patiently in New York on Coast to Coast AM. Go ahead, Lewis.
How you doing, Ian?
Yes, sir.
I'm presently in foreclosure. I was a fool. I had borrowed money from somebody, and they didn't want to wait for me to sell my house, and I was kind of pressured into taking an interest-bearing loan, and I nowhere near what the worth of my house was. My house is worth $300,000, which I have presently dropped to $200,000 to move it quick. They've been giving me a little time to sell it, but I'm getting a little nervous because time is running out for me.
Your question for Catherine Austin Fitz?
Yeah. Is there anything I can do at this time? I mean, I didn't file bankruptcy because I was afraid of these people. These people they're not even a registered mortgage company.
Well, who are they?
I mean, don't
give me a name, but I mean, are we talking about the mob? I mean, who
yeah,
are we talking?
I have a feeling that's who they are.
Catherine?
What you should do is very much, I would need to know a tremendous amount about the particulars, so I'm loath to give advice without having that, but what I will say is, usually in these situations, it pays to expend whatever effort you can to get mastery, but get somebody who's expert who can really help you. And there may, if you can find legal representation, there may be defenses you can assert. One of the problems, absolutely, that you bring up is that we're basically looking at patterns of racketeering in this market, and people literally do not feel physically safe to try and contest some of these arrangements.
Lewis, so, good luck to you on that. That's very interesting.
Yeah, you're in my prayers, Lewis.
Yeah, that's... I appreciate that. In fact, it reminds me that I'll hold on to that. I'll add that onto my list of things
I do want to say, because I think it's important for people to understand the kind of environment we're in. I won't go into the whole story, but essentially I was in litigation for 12 years with HUD and dealt with very significant physical harassment and surveillance, because the people who are running this game and playing in this game are not nice people. So, you know, we're not living in a Leave It to Beaver environment, and you have to be very careful. And that's one of the reasons I encourage everyone, Ian, who's got problems with their mortgage, to keep fantastic records and to have and get real mastery of what the arrangements are and communicate, keep records, document what you do, but stay on top of it, because you know, we are seeing situations where people are losing hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, because they get cornered like this, and it's dangerous because you're up against people who are expert at exploiting people who are not.
Well, you know, I'm intrigued by that, and I will then say this. I won't name the organization, but it's a major you know, financial lending group, and they bought the mortgage, which we got originally had a nice, and we still have a pretty good rate when we got a mortgage on this house a couple of years ago, and the loan says it's the payment is due on the first of the month, but we have until the 15th as a grace period. And it always, we'd always sort of, you know, send it on the 8th or something like that, or, you know, mailed it on the 10th, but it always got there. We never had a penalty, never so much as a late fee, but we were always somewhere between the 1st and the grace period on the 15th. Well, recently, I mean, within the last 6 months of these, the changes, I think in, on Wall Street and with this money lending, is that we get a call about the 3rd of the month.
Right.
And we get a call going, are you going to pay? When are you going to pay? You haven't sent it yet. We say, well, but the grace period's till the 15th. Yeah. So when are you going to send it today? Should we write down today is the day you're going to send it?
Because people are so, that all the cash flows in the economy are so stretched.
But it just seems
stretched like a bungee rope.
Yeah, it just but it seems like almost like a kind of almost like a mob kind of practice. It's really weird. I mean, it's either a grace period or it's not, and it's technically still is, but that doesn't stop. And they call every 3 or 4 days until they get it.
Right.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Jamie is in Oregon on Coast to Coast AM for Catherine Austin Fitz. Go ahead, Jamie.
Yes. Good morning, Ian.
Morning.
By the way, I think you should call yourself the Night Owl instead of the Night Watchman.
I like Night Watchman. Why Night Owl?
Because it's late at night, and you're always asking who.
Oh, that's pretty good, actually. Go ahead.
Here's my question for Catherine. Catherine, you've worked in the government, right?
Uh-huh.
So this may sound naive, but what do you think that the General Accounting Office should do? The government accounting office should do about this. They're the people that they're kind of like the whistleblowers, because I listen to National Public Radio and public broadcasting, and they're always cited as a source. They use the GAO to point out foibles.
Right. Okay. When I worked in Washington, the GAO was really one of the finest groups in town, in terms of, you know, ability and skills and responsibility. They recently changed their name from the General Accounting Office to the General Accountability Office. And I always took that as a bad sign, because their opportunity came when the $4 trillion went missing. That was a perfect time for the GAO, as the auditor, who's very involved in the audited financial process, to really put their foot down and say something. They didn't. They were, David Walker, the head of GAO at the time, was encouraged to publish the names of the contractors involved in the information and accounting systems at the agencies that were missing money, including HUD, the housing agency, and declined. And so they missed their opportunity, and that's when they changed their name from accounting to accountability, which I always thought was funny, except you're crying while you're laughing. And recently David Walker came out and made a statement last week, and if you go to my blog at my website, every week I put up sort of the top pick stories, and one of the stories that David Walker has stated is saying, you know, this is what happened to Rome, and if we're not careful, we'll go the way of Rome.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, and I would say that's the general account, the GAO has had a chance, and were absolutely complicit and went along. So they've watched, they've known what was happening all along, and sad to say, you know, and I say this, they're wonderful people at GAO who I respect and like, and, you know, and there's much about the organization, but we all knew when an organization refuses to obey the law and produce audited financial statements for more than a decade under both Republicans and Democrats, there's a deeper problem, and GAO has been quiet. And, and I think they, you know, they need to be held responsible for this, what has been, as an auditor, an unacceptable performance.
The chariot has left the barn, so to speak.
Right.
All right. Well, wildcard line, Bob is in Van Nuys, California, on Coast to Coast AM for Catherine Austin Fitz. Bob?
I got you. Wow. Well, the first time I've talked to you here, I spoke to Art and Nori, And it's your style is great. It falls in the category of regular guy.
Good. Well, I am, if you're asking, but that's because of the tapeworm. But go ahead.
Amazing. Anyway, Ms. Fitz, great. I heard you last time you were on with Nori. It's a fantastic show as well.
Glad.
And it appears that the whole country is being ran as a criminal enterprise at first look. But it's interesting. We're right now at an age, it's almost like we're back in the 60s again when people are worried of the atomic war. And right now, we've got countries that are uncivilized, you know, underdeveloped countries that are now acquiring weapons of mass destruction. And I understand our country, our government, is being run by the intelligence communities at this particular time, actually to poison us and put us into a certain position economically and militarily, into a position where we could actually secure places in the world to keep these events from taking place, such as the Middle East lighting up because we know they're developing WMDs. We've got countries around the world counterfeiting our money and spreading it all over the world. We've got Korea printing our money. We've got Russia printing our money. And we found machines and printing presses in Iraq. We found rooms full of $100 bills, if you remember that.
Right.
And that's all counterfeit money. So there's everybody. It's like the thing is, we scared the earth at one time. We're the big man on the block. Why? Because we had the atomic bomb. When that bomb went off, the whole world bowed to us. We were God. Now everybody's got the bomb, and everybody's pointing their guns at our head. So everybody's counterfeiting our money, trying to take over our country, and now we've got our intelligence communities have poised themselves and are now running our country economically and trying to reestablish a superpower again.
So well, let's get little time here for Catherine to respond to that. Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, what we're seeing is a deterioration of the rule of law globally. Now we've been, you know, we've sort of been picking on ourselves and talking about the deterioration here in the States, but it's going on globally. And part of what you're seeing with the war on terrorism is leadership trying to figure out how to continue to exercise that dominance in an environment where technology is becoming far more available and ubiquitous. So I agree with everything that you've said, Bob. I think that, you know, that is one of the dynamics that is causing this kind of insecurity.
Fascinating. And yet we're just still not done. And hang on, because we'll get to as many callers as we can between now and the end of the show with Catherine Austin Fitz. And I guess that sets the table for a question I have to ask you about the stories of the North American Union and what your thought is then on the role of NAFTA in our economy and the future of the United States. We'll just see what she says coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. And we're talking with Catherine Austin Fitz, who you can link up to via coasttocoastam.com. Read more about her views on this tapeworm economy, how essentially an oligarchy of a few are manipulating the host body of the United States, and how so much of what we're hearing in the news is evidence of this, if we just take the time to peel back the headlines a little bit. And so that the last caller brings me to this thing that's been rumbling around in my head about the North American Union, which is kind of, you know, it's a big internet rumor. Maybe there's something to it, but I don't know. But the presumption here, and a lot of people I really like believe in this, but I don't think I've been able to make the jump yet, that the sovereignty of our government is being handed over to a triumvirate of leaders from Mexico, Canada, and the United States to form this new North American Union, and that new rules of both the economy and of power sharing would be in effect then. But the way you talk about the economy, that would seem like the last thing that this tapeworm would want, an adjustment on the host body. Any thought on that?
I think what you're watching is remember, there is no such thing as, we don't have a sovereign government. And we haven't had one for quite some time. I mean, the proof, the documentation behind fraud or voter fraud is pretty significant. But even if it weren't, if what everybody wants, because our economy at this point is highly dependent, you know, families, communities, highly dependent on government credit and government appropriations and spending. So if everybody needs more money from the government and the government information and accounting systems, and financing is organized and controlled by private defense contractors and banks who are financing globally, then there is no government. So I think what we're watching, you know, that's why I use the word financial coup d'etat, we're watching the government being re-engineered through the financial mechanism into something else, and that whatever that something else is, whether it's called the North American Union or whatever, which I think is part of what's happening, it's a centralization of control of the economy and the governance. We're essentially where this is going is we're looking to manage the resources on planet Earth through corporations and banks, as opposed to through sovereign governments, as you and I, you know, believe they existed, you know, as we were taught in civic class.
Mm. How do you see NAFTA? And then I'll get a break in.
I simply see NAFTA as a mechanism by which global investors can organize the regulation and law that applies to places and economies so that it makes life simple for them. So it's a way of organizing the rules top down, so it's easy for a few investors to operate across many different, and I think that's one of the pushes for one world currency, because it makes it much easier to organize and operate globally than when you have to deal with, you know, 5,000 counties with 5,000 different rules. And simply changing the rules and organizing them top down makes it much easier for you to exercise political and economic control top down.
If it's true that a few are operating at a kind of pump and dump cycle where they're one neighborhood, one state, one country at a time, and you said that we're leading at a time when our planet may be pumped and dumped, where would those people go after the dump?
Well, that's a pretty good question. You know, obviously there's plenty of land space on the planet, but that does raise the question of, you know, what is the maximum population we can tolerate? And it's very interesting, after 9/11, everybody sort of announced, oh, we're doing business in Dubai. Now, partly, you know, Halliburton has moved their operations out of the country.
Right, they were going to, right, yeah.
You know, so these folks seem to move from place to place. You know, you'll as you drive around the country, you'll see a lot more gated communities in rural areas with fabulous mansions and people, you know, building first or second homes way outside of the cities. But I think that's a very good question. How do you expect to live on a planet? And I would say, as a spiritual person, how do you expect to, have an immortal soul if you behave like this? And I think that's a real question.
We'll get everybody else's questions coming up next for Catherine Austin Fitz on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. First-time caller line for Catherine Austin Fitz. Sean is in Michigan on Coast to Coast AM. Sean?
Hi. When the feds inject liquidity into the market, exactly where does it come from and who gets it, and do they have to pay it back?
That's an excellent question, and I don't know the answer. One of the things they're doing is they're lending at the discount window. So they're lending to member banks who are able to borrow. One of the things that was reported was that what they're doing is they're lending and they're accepting much lower collateral. So let's say I have a hedge fund and it's full of subprime paper, which is really, say, it's worth 10 cents on the dollar. But its nominal value is a dollar. So the Fed is letting me borrow at low interest expense and value it at a dollar, even though it's worth much less, or there's no market for it. So it's kind of below market rate loans. What we saw at the end of the last housing bubble, the story I was describing earlier, where the Fed is permitting, or different steps are being taken so people can use the federal credit to borrow at one rate and invest in another rate. That is a mechanism that allows you to print profits that you never have to pay back. So I suspect that there's some bailing out going on that in essence is rigged profits. I'll give you another example. We've heard about the Japanese carry trade where the Japanese banks, central bank was lending to hedge funds. It was reported at rates of 0.5% or 1%. Well, if you and I can borrow, for 1% and turn around and invest it in a variety of ways that we can make much more, you know, that's an insider deal that sort of rigs profit. So I suspect that some will never have to be paid back. Some technically will have to be paid back. But what is going to happen is, and let me give you an example. I live in a farming community. We have farmers who have planted twice this year. The first time we had a cold snap. The second time we've had a very serious drought. There's various years drought throughout the country. Those farmers are not able to finance, their burnt corn at 4%, let alone, value it as being worth everything they paid to plant it. And so it's an extraordinary, extraordinary benefit that Wall Street is getting. And, of course, you know, what they, I assume, are saying is if we don't get it, the global financial system will melt down. Well, there's only so many times you can proceed to support the unproductive on the threat that if you don't, they'll melt down. I mean, what we need is for them to stop draining the productive part of the economy. So, these kinds of bailouts are ultimately are more dangerous. And I think if I could deliver one warning, it would be watch out for what's going to happen to the price of food. Because every time you bail out these folks, you're creating and printing more money.
To mention with the hurricane coming,
right.
the price of gas, if it's really headed toward South Texas, waiting for that to jump too. Let's get a few more callers in your wildcard line. Enrico is in Florida on Coast to Coast AM for Catherine Austin Fitz. Enrico?
Thank you. Provocative program tonight. Catherine, if we owe the Chinese $1.3 trillion, what does it consist of? Treasury bills, treasury notes, treasury bonds with stated maturities, or are they demand instruments?
Generally, it's treasury securities, but my understanding from those who know more about this than I do is that the Chinese have been trying to shift more and more of that surplus into stocks and investment positions that represent tangible resources.
Who can blame them?
For example, if I own a treasury security and we print, money in bailouts, then the value of those securities diminish with inflation. But if I buy 4.9% of a stock, say of a oil company, then I've got real tangible resources, and as inflation gets worse, the value of those stocks will rise.
Wildcard line, Jim is in Burbank on Coast to Coast AM for Catherine Austin Fitz. Jim?
Yes. Good evening, Catherine.
Hi.
I wanted to tell you, I guess I have to go really fast. I've been in the aircraft manufacturing industry for 32 years. I've had my own shop since 1984. A lot of my experience is in landing gear and the high-strength components and bolts. Most are chrome-plated and ground, made from forgings of the highest-strength steel and very precise, exacting work, highly critical. Well, I recent trip to my chrome plater 4 years ago, I noticed that I didn't see any of that work. There's usually hydraulic pistons, rows and rows of them, stacks of them, and those high-strength bolts and landing gear components and so forth. I said, where is all this work? He said, it's being done overseas. I said, it's illegal. The law always stated that domestic aircraft that flies in our skies had to be domestic materials and domestic workmanship. With very little fanfare, I'll say it that way, with very little fanfare, that law was changed.
Right. I guess that's not a surprise to Catherine. Catherine, comment on that?
Right. What we've been doing is our knowledge of how to make things and the operations of making them have been steadily moved abroad, and surprisingly not in not always in ways that are economic, but certainly economic for the people who own them once they're moved.
Well, let's go abroad. Let's go to the international line. Paul is in Hong Kong on Coast to Coast AM for Catherine Austin Fitz. Paul?
Hi, Ian. Thanks for taking my call. Two quick comments. The reason the Chinese hold so much in the way of T-bills, it's a way for them to stabilize the renminbi against the U.S. dollar. And it's a couple reasons, mostly to stabilize the currency. But if you really want to understand what's happening to the U.S., and I'm an American, 100 million Chinese over the last 24 months moved from poverty to the middle class, which is adding a very, very stable society over here, which I think in the end is good. Granted, our standard of living is decreasing somewhat, but theirs is increasing. If I just have Catherine make a comment on that.
Go ahead.
The Chinese people are some of the hardest working, most productive people in the world. And there's no doubt about it. If you spend any time in 1997, I had the opportunity to go to Shanghai and Beijing, and it's absolutely phenomenal how dynamic the growth is. Now, part of that is all the money that's been pulled out of the first world and invested there, but also part of it is you have a very intelligent, very hardworking, phenomenally entrepreneurial culture, and so, you know, your comment is well taken. I mean, there's no doubt about it that you have productivity rates in Asia, which are rising and attracting a lot of this investment and falling in America, in the first world, and that's part of what we're watching.
Barb, west of the Rockies in Idaho on Coast to Coast AM for Catherine Austin Fitz. Barb?
Great show. Thank you, Ian and Catherine. Yes, I'm a loan officer in Idaho, and there's a couple things. I'll be quick. It's interesting that the bankruptcy laws changed right before this crash. I find that suspect. But also the 2 and 3 year ARMs, there was no protection for borrowers. They would come in with a loan where they barely qualified while the rates are going up. They've got 2 to 3 years to refi that home. How are they going to do it when they're not making any more money?
Right.
And I wanted to pass that on to Catherine and get her take on it. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Go ahead.
We've been using debt to keep an economy going that's not working. And, you know, so rather than face the fundamental issues of how we re-engineer government money, both nationally and by place, and how we get our skills up, you know, we've delayed. In this vein, I went into the dentist's office about 2 years ago, and there was a little announcement that there was a presentation over at the courthouse that would teach you how you could buy a house, pay for the house with all financing, pay the expenses with all financing, and take money out of the deal for day-to-day expenses. So if you were broke and didn't have a job, the way you could get enough money to live for the next couple months was to go buy a house.
Ugh.
So, so we're looking at using debt to keep things going rather than sitting down and facing the music in a way that will start to turn things around.
All right, let's take a minute here to talk about what you recommend for the next, say, 5 years, 10 years, in order to hedge against this. If somebody listening, the average person, you know, a quarter of their income goes to pay their, a quarter to a third of their income goes to pay their mortgage, they're carrying a little bit of credit card debt, they own most of their car, what do you recommend they do to feel less vulnerable than they might be feeling after listening to this show?
Okay, the first thing I recommend to people that they do is, to the extent possible, to turn off their television. According to the last general accounting office, I met with a general accounting office person about a year ago who announced that the latest statistics, according to the Census Department, showed that the average American watched 8.5 hours of TV a day. Now, I assume, Ian, that those statistics show that, you know, that's we have our TV on when we're doing other things, but the most important thing people can do is start to get reliable sources of information. Now, if they're listening to Coast, it's a more sophisticated cat. But you know, the first thing you need to do is not let the tape worm into your mind. So turn off your TV. The second thing we need to do is to get healthy. If you look at the things that cause bankruptcies or cause foreclosures, one of the biggest economic problems is health. And so anything we can do to improve the quality of our food and water and our health is really important, and it's an economic issue. The next thing we need to do is we need to lower our debt. Anything you can do to pay down your debt, get out of credit card, to the extent that people in communities can start to organize and come together, and possibly through the community banks and credit unions, to find ways of lowering our cost of borrowing. It's really important. Danny Schechter has a new DVD called In Debt We Trust, which I really recommend to people, and it shows you how expensive and predatory sort of the financing arrangements are. So that's the first thing. There's a lot that family and friends can do together to consolidate. One of the most important things we need to do in a period where we're facing inflation is to start to re-engineer our expenses down, simplify our possessions. I could go on and on. We have a whole, if you come to our website, we have a whole series of audio seminars that go into and address these issues. One of the biggest opportunities is what I mentioned before, which is as the credit crunch continues to wave through the economy, the little guys are going to be have more expensive arrangements to borrow. And that's an opportunity for people who, in communities right now, who are investing in big corporations to start to pull their money out and start to pull money to finance little guys in communities. So there's a lot of things we do, but we're going to have to start thinking of very different ways of organizing ourselves and not turning over our finances to people who are managing our money this way.
My apologies to everybody who couldn't get on because the lines were locked for Catherine Austin Fitz, which just means we'll just have to have you back sometime. And unfortunately, the way things are going, perhaps sooner as opposed to later, before it's too late. And thank you. And
thank
link
you,
up
Ian.
To link up to her through coasttocoastam.com, and keep your spirit up. Don't give up yet. It's not too late. Deus Tiamat, and I do too.